my lesson plan really is just to discuss some of the happenings of St. Francis through his chapter in I. Francis' book called Claire. And Claire, my sister, is the emphasis of the book. Has anybody read the book? Otherwise, I can be the expert, and that makes me a professor, too. Oh, okay, we got two readers that can help me out in the process. But what I really want us to do is to first look at all the ways we are capable of excluding people rather than including them by the various kinds of groups there are in our society first, and then those same groups really sort of appear in the church. And why I think we need to do that is that, as I see it, knowledge of what is happening is important, and we can fill in the knowledges, but awareness is absolutely essential to use the knowledge in any action that we're going to take in the future. And of course, that's the whole purpose of any of our discussions here, is that we have some knowledge to base what we're going to do on. We have an awareness, and then that the attitude change, if it's needed, can help us to be change agents within ourselves as well as within either the church and even more so in our daily lives. So that's sort of my purpose. And I think that all of us can change and have changed, if you think of yourself 5 years ago and today in your thinking, that most of you have probably become more inclusive, even if it's only in inclusive language that you've been forced into in some ways, or in that you've gotten older, and so you now see that there's a new group that you are a part of, and that some of those older new groups have been exclusive in their own way. And so I think we have changed, and I sort of agree with, was it William James who said, by changing the inner aspects of our thinking and heart, we can change the outer aspects of our lives. And so that's kind of the behind purpose, but we do have Francis as a help for us as we're discussing this. So I have on the board here just a few of beginning groups that are often excluded rather than included. The singles, don't single out the singles. And here we have what I call my Noah's Ark 2x2 syndrome that I talked about the other day in a very picturesque form. And then that the church is 99.9% male dominated is representative of the concept that is anti-Claire, really, in where the power structure is, but even more, because it is male-dominated, it's the concept of Jacob's ladder of one is greater than the other. And that's probably the greatest problem in inclusive and exclusive relationships, is that we seem to put it on a hierarchy rather than an equal kind of basis. And of course, that's been the problem with singles. They have been excluded honored only as second-class citizens rather than equal, and the same in the male-dominated. David is representative of two kinds of people. If David couldn't tie his shoes at 8, what are we probably suggesting that he is? He's either mentally retarded or he is physically handicapped. Mm-hmm. And those are two of the most excluded groups anywhere in our society. And remember, 10% of our society is made up of mentally retarded individuals, mentally slower. And the worst of the group, if you're in education at all, is the slow learner. Because the slow learner becomes the slow adult. And we don't really communicate then as well with that slow learner. And so really, our mental handicapped people are almost more difficult to deal with. In the world of sport, which you'll find my references are generally to because that's what I know the most, what happens to the fat second grade boy in sport when he becomes a 10th grader?
He's excluded.
Maybe he is excluded. The first thing we do is have the captains. If any of you were at Mr. Lester's one yesterday, afternoon where he talked about, he was in fourth grade, any of you at that meeting, and he was excluded well, he wasn't exactly excluded. They had to let him play, but he was the last child selected for a team. And then he cried. Mm-hmm. And so in the stereotype world, he had two strikes against him. And I don't know if he's an athlete today, but I would assume not. By the basis of what we do with that second grader, we exclude him.
He said today he likes to run.
Yeah, that is what a non-athlete does, by the way. And that's why women, I believe, are moving to jogging, because they have been so handicapped in the past, in the sports life, that jogging is the only thing that they can do that doesn't take a long time to learn. And I think that's why they're runners and joggers.
And walkers.
It's because they were excluded. Our whole women's generation was excluded from the sports world. You know, you had to be pretty aggressive to be a sportswoman. You know, that I ended up a sportswoman is proof of my aggressive being. I simply wouldn't have been able to continue in it. I could have been in something nice like tennis, but actually I was in softball and basketball, and that's not nice. Or track, and that wasn't nice. Jogging is nice. You know? But with our handicap, the mental handicap we may have more difficulties with, but the physically handicapped. How many of your churches 10 years ago had ramps for your people to come to church?
Oh, some of the old churches are unreal. Mm-hmm. Because the stairs, I was in a church in Ontario this spring, and I couldn't believe it. The amount of stairs that had to be climbed to get to that sanctuary, both outside and inside. Mm-hmm.
So who are they also excluding now, besides the really
elderly? The elderly. I know this was an elderly congregation that must have many elderly within a small town.
Mm-hmm. How, when we start looking at our exclusiveness, how exclusive are we in terms of older people?
We put them in institutions.
Institutionalize them, and we institutionalize them in our thinking even before mm-hmm. they're ever institutionalized.
Right.
And it's not so much the institutionalized ones that really need care that bother me as much as all of that age in between, mm-hmm. the 65 mm-hmm. to 85 or whenever. Gertrude and I talk a lot, and this morning we were talking about the exclusiveness, and she said, well, as I see it, as long as I am included until my mind really goes, and when my mind really goes, then I want to go to the nursing home or to wherever. Because if I really don't know them and I can't identify with them, then I think I am a burden, and that's the worst thing I want to be. But until that moment, let me talk and live as a human being. Mm-hmm. And I think that, we don't always do that. Some way or other, we honor them, but we honor them in a corner. And you're not honoring anybody when they're in a corner. Or respecting them.
When you're in an institution visiting, maybe, and you watch the care that is given there, and many of them, you notice that the patients are not honored. You can sense that by the way they're addressed. They're called dearie or honey or by their
girly?
First name or girly, yes. Or, you know, first name lots of times in a disrespect, in a patronizing way.
Patronizing is one
terrible.
Of the key words.
And it's the sense that, oh, well, that person won't understand. Mm-hmm. And I would say, too, you know, Gertrude's idea about going away because she would be a burden when her mind was gone, but there is still the person in there and can often be reached. You know, it's often aware, even though the mind seems to be gone. And I don't think we should treat one another disparagingly at any stage.
And certainly
when the mind seems gone.
He and I, Francis. I think it's very interesting how in his final hours, or year really, Claire leaves her commitment to the world that she has had as a poverty and takes care of Francis. I think it's great for the woman concept too, that she was a very independent, strong woman throughout her life, but that the nurturing role is in fact embedded in all of us somewhere. And that she then returns to taking care of Francis. And I think it's an important concept to remember as you study her as a sister, that in spite of what she has done, and in the chapter it talks about her standing guard when a large group of men came and were going to go and use the women in the nunnery, And she just stood there as a human blockade. And they retreated. An illustration of her strength, but then her nurturing power for when he was sick and she took care of him until the end of his life. And I think that's one of the things in inclusiveness to think about. What other groups do you see that we have, or they have, or somebody has excluded in our society?
Children sometimes, I
think. Okay, children are excluded. We patronize children. Mm-hmm. And then the next group, right above them, the teenagers. If there's any wasted group of humanity, it's the teenagers. Because we don't very often talk to them really as human beings. Mm-hmm. And it's not the parents, as I see it, who have that responsibility. But it's someone like me, it's someone like you with your friends' children. Mm-hmm. If there's any reaching of kids, it's not parents that can reach their kids very often. Mm-hmm. But it's somebody else. Mm-hmm. I've been fortunate to be very close to the Lehman family. And they have 7 children. And particularly Lisa, who has just left, from a 14-year-old on, we had a relationship in which it was not a sort of teacher, student, or aunt, but some way or other, an equal one. We started discussing some things that she was interested in. And she is the most honest person with me. She went to the singles session that I had and told me all the things that were good and all the things that were bad. And where else would I get such an evaluation when I'm a teacher? The problem with being a teacher is that a lot of the teenagers then never see you as just a human being. My niece has the same role. Believe me, she can tell me what's wrong. She now is much older. But I would have lost all of that. And that's one of the big problems of exclusion as I see it. And certainly in St. Francis, what if Claire hadn't been given the freedom to become a priest, which is really what she did. She was not a nun. She really was a priest, but in her own kind of way. And when I think of how we waste the teenagers' brains and abilities, and yet parents can't get them to do anything, as I see it. But they're interested in adult things. They really are.
I have a lovely 13-year-old child who just became a complete problem. You know, summer came and she went to bed. That's it. 2 weeks she went to bed. I mean, this kid, I said, here's your piano, here's your sax, here's his free time, let's go here, let's go there, nothing, to bed. Said, I have enough of this. So I got her up, got her dressed, got her down to the hospital, said, put on this nice little perky pink uniform and volunteer. Well, she volunteered, there wasn't a junior level, she volunteered on the adult level, they accepted her. Just changed her whole personality. They accepted her as a person. And she really did some worthwhile things while, you know, the summer went along, you know. And I was amazed. I couldn't get her out of bed. And yet, you know, I said, you're going to be late. And yet when she had the responsibility of being there on her own, she was up, dressed, ready, gone, out the door. And I when they were young, you just get them up and you program them into whatever, and they do it. But I couldn't get this teenager out of bed. And she's, you know, my height and struggling. I said, I'll leave you in bed, you know. I can't get you out of bed. But they just need to work as adults.
And I think they're the same as singles. They need to have time alone with just teenagers and whatever their teenage thing is. Mm-hmm. But that we exclude them then from the adult world when they're ready to be adults. In the church, they're ready. They understand Christianity. Perhaps better, and that's what's scary. I mean, you know, they see the double standards of their parents sometimes, mm-hmm. and that really is a difficulty. One of the authors, and I never can remember the author, but the name of the book is The Greening of America. Mm-hmm. And it really tells the story of the double standards of parents and children and how they ended up, therefore, as they did, and that they will merge back in, and they have. Into the establishment by 30 or whatever. But if we could have somebody that could communicate with them when the parents cannot, from that 16, 14 on to even 25, they are ready for adult discussion and we exclude them because after all, they're flighty teenagers.
Isn't it interesting that that's the group, you know, we exclude that way, and yet they are the ones who are recalled to go do the wars for us.
Right.
The fighting. Mm-hmm. And they are also the group that are the most, I think, the most underemployed right now, and without jobs.
Half of the Washington, D.C. 18 to 20-year-old black males are unemployed.
And then we wonder why we have problem teenagers. Mm-hmm. And young adults.
Well, that honesty that you spoke of, that viewing of the double standard, is so hard to take when it's directed against people that are other than the teenage. You know, that's why I think they're so threatening to us. And so we kind of shut them in. And another group that kind of just reminded me of the gifted, you know, you talked about the handicap physically and mentally, and then the teenagers, and this made me think, well, really gifted people, especially young people, are a threat to us lots of times, and we don't provide nurture and relationships with them as we could and should.
I think that's a really difficult group, and that's a group that's scary, that we better.
Yeah.
Because they're the 150 IQ kids that are lost. What was it, a 17-year-old University of Michigan sophomore committed suicide, and he had an IQ of 180. It's the waste that is scary. Mm-hmm. And that's what St. Francis talks about in Claire, that how can we exclude Claire when she is so good, she is so bright, she gives strength to the men by her a variety of abilities. And so by saying to Claire, you go back to the nunnery and do those helping, healing things only, we're excluding a theological genius, maybe. And certainly if you look at Nancy Winner, mm-hmm. if she had been born Missouri Synod, mm-hmm. then you would have had a waste product. Sure, there's other things that you can do. Everybody's not called to certain things. But what we really would have is a form of a waste of talent. And certainly in the gifts of grace idea, all of the talent. Look at all of the civil engineers we've missed. Look at all of the great nurses, people that could work for the telephone company, male secretaries that can spell, that we've missed in society. What other groups are there that we exclude? What's the huge bit? We don't see any of them here, and we see one family of them.
The minorities of many
Churches. All the minorities, particularly the blacks. When you look at the exclusion of blacks in our society, and what was it all based on? Why don't we exclude blacks? I mean, so they have different skin. What did it come from?
Fear of being unknown. We don't know them.
We don't know them? Why did we let it start? After the Civil War, why didn't everybody then just hippity-hop into this open friendship? Why didn't it happen?
Because I think people, it makes them feel superior when they think. I mean, it's power. It was power, I would think. I wasn't brought up here, so I don't know. But is it because it makes people feel better if they feel superior? Or?
According to the sociologists, we have to have somebody beneath us. Mm-hmm. That it is absolutely essential. And again, because I only know sport, look at the sport world. What is the worst occupation of an athlete? Which sport seems the most lowly to you, in spite of whatever they might be making on it financially? Boxing. Mm-hmm. When you think of it, who's in boxing?
Blacks.
The winners basically are blacks. And what it has to do with is that boxing is a violent sport. It is not accepted by the elite class. Now, in South Africa, it's opposite. Boxers are whites, and they are accepted within the society. But who started to be great boxers in this country? This is your sport history lesson for the day. The Irish. Why the Irish? Why were the Irish greater boxers than the blacks originally?
They were persecuted.
They were the persecuted group. They came over particularly in the 1840s. They had no money. They were potato farmers. They had given their lives for several years. And so they became boxers, and great boxers. And if you know anything about boxing, you know the Dempsey, the Johnsons, all of these are Irish boxers. But then the Irish moved up a step in society. The Civil War came, and we had the good old blacks to pick on. And we have the social Darwin theory, survival of the fittest is right, male. And so the blacks then become important in sport.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll find in sport that blacks were allowed with the whites until about the 1880s. And that was the time the South learned that they could get away with Jim Crow laws. And so they couldn't be beaten by a black because then they've got someone equal with them. So to keep them, to be sure that physically they were not equal, you don't box them, then you don't know. And you don't jockey with them in horse racing, you don't ride bicycle races, you don't play baseball, you don't let them in football, and you've got not only exclusion, but the whole really biases. And that's where blacks entered our society, when we were struggling. The ethnic groups then, the Irish, is another group that we begin to look at. What ethnic groups particularly are persecuted in our society, or at least excluded, if not?
Southeast Asians.
Okay, Southeast Chinese. Asians, mm-hmm. Chinese, the whole Orientals. After all, how did the Orientals happen to come here?
They brought here for labor on the railroads.
Labor for the railroads. Mm-hmm. Thousands of them die. Mm-hmm. Their women are not permitted over. Mm-hmm. They have to work from 5 to 7 years before they have enough money for their wives to come over. And this was 1870s all the way to the 20th century. And so the labor market, which makes them, we can put them inferior. What other group?
Chicanos.
The Chicanos. Okay. After all, we can do anything we want to the Indians. And now we might be on guilt trip with them. But they definitely are. Which other ones in today's society? Hispanics? Mm-hmm. Anyone that speaks Spanish, there's something wrong with them. In spite of the fact that at least the government has taken an interest, if nothing else, in the children of these. But they definitely, as they move into our churches, we're worse with ethnic groups, I think, than we have ever been. If we just look around at how many we have here, mm-hmm. or even how many blacks we have, we can see that we have practiced exclusion. Now, there may not be any in your community, but there may be. There may not be a lot of them. Who else have we excluded?
Homosexuals.
Homosexuals, a number one exclusion. How do we know that? Because in Washington, D.C., they have formed a gay church. Why would any group have to form a church of their own? Why would anybody do that? Because they have to feel unwelcome in their own churches. Mm-hmm. Now, I do a lot of women's rights work in Washington, D.C., so I associate with a lot of gay women. And so I've tried to find out how they think, how they feel. And they often exclude me. I'm invited to some cocktail parties and some cocktail parties. I'm not because I'm straight. And it irritates them. And it doesn't when you get talking to them person to person. I don't really irritate them. But they assume every straight person is not going to accept them. So if you say you're straight or act like you are, in terms of relationships, and even if you don't act like it, they want to know the fact first, and then you have to prove yourself instead of them having to prove themselves. And I understand that perfectly well, because they have been ostracized. But once having associated with them and accepted them as human beings, they think, I've really learned a lot about them, and about why they have formed their own church and their own ministers. And part of it has to do with simply the cold feelings in the church. They are accepted insofar as you can take communion. But the whole concept of a fallen society, no one really accepts within them. And if we knew for sure that all the females were having sexual relations with men every day, we might start ostracizing them too. But because there's a larger percentage doing that, we can't quite do that. But in our heads, we may do that anyway. If we know that the woman in the pew here is really having an affair with John over there, we really do ostracize them the same. But the gays are even more ostracized. What's the difficulty of that in terms of our society or in terms of our church, of them forming their own? What difference does that make? Let them.
That locks up any understanding or any relationship that might be formed, any awareness of one another as people.
Okay. If I hadn't forced my way into the group, I would never understand a lot of things that I understand about how they're feeling. They're not feeling much different than blacks, than divorced women or divorced men, but somewhat even more bitter because of what society has decided. Some way that one thing is worse than another. You know, stealing is worse than borrowing forever. And so same-sex preference is worse than promiscuous heterosexual. I mean, somewhere or other, we've put value judgments. And we're, if all of us were perfect, it'd be all right. But since none of us seem to be, we all have whatever is our thing. And so I think that that is certainly evidence of an excluded group. The other problem with excluding them is their talent. If you take that average IQ of the woman, gay, in Washington, D.C., and the groups that I know, you would be far above the average IQ. And so you're taking a whole group and not having them contribute where they could just be in the flow of society. We're also keeping them out of government. So they may be a great government worker, but we're ostracizing them. And that's one of the best examples, just because it happens to be so prevalent today. And it doesn't really matter to me whether it's choice or have to. The same is true with heterosexuals. You know, we can either choose to go ahead and have an affair or not to. We're still free, no matter what our preferences are. What other group is?
You mentioned divorced people in our church setting there, or single parents there frequently.
Single parents, either by divorce or death, are not quite in the same, because you get sympathy longer if you're single through death of the partner. There's much more understanding than single through divorce. Which one may need it more in terms of understanding? The divorce may. Now, the suddenness of death and the grief of always and ever knowing that you cannot communicate again with that individual is more frightening. And divorce may have taken a process. But in some ways, it's worse because of the failure concept and the church's stand. And even if the church says it's okay, when they start dealing with preachers, then they start saying, no, it's not okay, which means they must not think it's okay in the first place. Or why does the preacher can't do it? The pastor can't do it. But it's okay if the lay people do. In the lay people's minds is the same idea then that I am wrong. And certainly Kirky's discussion, if any of you were able to hear that, whether she was the guilty party or not, she felt complete guilt and probably was not. And so the divorce is certainly a group that the church, does society ostracize the divorced? Which would you say does it more, church or society?
Church,
which is scary as can be. That the church really does more. Now, the only reason they're ostracized in society is because they're single. I mean, there's something successful about them in society. I mean, they're really better people being divorced, because after all, they made it once. Doesn't matter that they fail later, but they made it once. So society really accepts the divorce better, and particularly if they have children, because then you're relating to the normal family in spite of one or the other partner missing. More, however, society does not accept the divorced male with children. Mm. When you think about the hardest role, and harder than single, I think it's the divorced man who has the children. Not so much in debt, because then everybody comes around. But why did you take the child from your wife? And so it's one of the excluded kinds of happenings, perhaps. Anybody else excluded?
I think.
Jews.
Certainly, in our minds, the Jew is far worse than any other ethnic group or blacks in the feeling of exclusion that they feel. Even in school, they have their dandruff up. And no group has their dandruff up unless somebody's made them. And I think that that's, and they too are a creative group. I don't care what anybody says, they are unusually creative, sensitive, and bright, mm-hmm. on the average, in our country at least.
Think of so many other tainters, you know, that are Jewish.
And Einstein, mm-hmm. and a few are scientists, the Rosenbergs kinds of scientists. I worked at a private camp for 6 summers, private Jewish camp. And I tell you, those kids were unusual. And they were on a quota system for Wellesley. Here are IQs of 140, and they couldn't get in Wellesley or Harvard. Well, they couldn't get in Harvard anyway, they were women at the time. But it blows my mind of what we've done for the group. What other?
I think the terminally ill. I think church, I know we have care groups and share groups and visitation groups, but somehow when you go into the person's room, it is just not the same. You don't address what the person wants to talk about. You talk about the flowers or this nice wallpaper, or your kids here to see you, those flowers are nice. Gee, I have to go.
Mm. Well, I think many people don't know what to say or what to do when you go into a...
I think the church, you know, along with the courses that we offer in marriage and family life and in everything, we offer formal courses. I think there should be a basic course for everybody that you take. Is someone you're going to have to be faced with a situation sooner or later, whether it's your own family or friends, is how to, or what to say, or what not to say, or how to just listen.
I think that they really are. It's easier for me. In fact, I have a very good friend who did not, I am sure, go home to watch her father die because she was so fearful of death. She found all kinds of reasons of why he was going to survive until Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And he didn't survive until Thanksgiving. And it will always be on her heart and mind. And I blame it on the church and all of us. And I wish I had said, go to your father. And I didn't have guts enough to say that. We went on a camping trip instead. And it wasn't really, though, until the middle of it that I realized she didn't want to see her father, mm-hmm. in spite of the fact that he wanted her to see her. Although he had had mental problems too. I mean, he was 87, I think. But it was not knowing what to do with the terminal.
Even in the hospitals, you know, when a patient comes in, and they're on the floor, and they move them to the oncology floor, you know, the terminal floor. Where are they placed? The end of the hall. The closer they are to death, the farther away they are from people. And, you know, and as the rooms change daily, they say, oh, we're going to move your room to be more comfortable down here. They're just farther away from people and nursing staff. So the nursing staff doesn't have to see them, deal with them regularly. I mean, if you're right across from the nursing station, every time she comes out to get bed, she looks in, she waves, she says, she acknowledges the fact that you're at least alive. But if you're down at the end of the hall, she doesn't have to go to your room. Mm-hmm. She isn't going to go to your room. And the doctors, if you're the last one on the rounds, which is usually the most seriously ill, they get the least amount of time.
I mean, there's a lot involved in that, because not only do you don't know how to act yourself, it's also reminding of you that you someday are going to face that same experience, and you just don't like to be reminded.
I wonder if this is the reason we feel, I mean, everybody feels uncomfortable. Yeah. With, when you know somebody's dying, it makes you feel uncomfortable. And I have sometimes wondered, why? Is it because it reflects, I know it's one of the things, if you're so sorry for the person, you don't know what to do. The other thing is it sort of a selfish feeling, oh my God, you know, this is pointing, and particularly if they're in your own age group, you know, then it really sort of points it home. Mm-hmm. And you get so afraid. And yet if we believe, as we all say we do, we shouldn't be that afraid. You know, really.
Any other?
Like overweight people.
Yeah, somebody else. Yes. The first thing I want to do is to crawl in a hole. That is probably my number one anti. And part of it has to do with my understanding of nutrition and the physiology of the body. I know we don't have to be overweight. And so then I blame them. And I don't know if I'm afraid that I'm going to be overweight any day now. And I was telling the last group that I even hate men worse for being overweight because they don't have to be as overweight as women physiologically. Physiologically, women will, by their fatty tissues and adipose fat, be more overweight and struggle with it more than males, because the male hormone does not secrete the same kind of fatty tissue. So I dislike them even more. And cross them off my list. Yeah. Some way, because of a stereotyping of what fat people are. They're jolly, they're not disciplined, they're this or they're that. That affects us.
My husband and I have been
on a weight kick. He's lost 38 pounds and I've lost 20, which I don't like. But nevertheless, we came up here Monday, and by yesterday I was very, very upset with Holden. I mean, I was so furious. I was ready to get back on the boat and go home. I said, I cannot stay another week. I said, I can't. Everything that we've learned so hard and tried so hard for 8 months to do, they just turned it around. Bread every meal. I mean, we haven't had a slice of bread since, maybe Christmas, you know, and it was a slice of bread.
You know? And wouldn't you like a nice plate of raw vegetables?
Some good, you know, chicken. And then make you feel so guilty about not having, or you have a wing for dinner, or a chicken leg. And actually what we'd have at home was a breast skin, you know, which would be ample. But a wing with all the fat tissue on it just doesn't cut it with us, you know. And so where do we head for? Ice cream. And then guilt all night long. And you come back.
Just
my education.
Just
my education. For us, this is a renewal vacation. It's not, we did not want to come back heavier. We both said that. We both fall into the same.
Just do take more walks.
But you know, you might not be heavier. I come up here needing the bread and I've gone out there and I'm no heavier.
Well, last year we went home 12 pounds heavier, so I can't do that. Well,
you knew what you were coming into. What
Richard Simmons says, he says, okay, if you have that piece of pie, just exercise that much more.
That's right. You know, it's the whole input-output concept.
Yeah. But I mean, there's the whole thing of, and you're in this captive situation, and it tastes good, you know, and everybody's doing it, and she's thin, and he's thin, and they...
And then also bring fruit when you come.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll smuggle apples in ours.
Oh, we
learned that. That's the
first thing. We were trying to stay in line, and they keep pitching out the fruit. We stop at Safeway again, and we go through the line, and then they get it back.
There are ways I think we can cope on a temporary thing. Yeah. You were here all winter.
But it is another one of our exclusive powers, which gives us, again, power, which is the whole exclusive kind of thing.
On a small scale, according to a couple of friends of mine, our individual society here in America tends to exclude clergy's wives. I don't know any clergy husbands, but I imagine two friends of mine whose husbands are pastors.
Yeah, Sandy was talking about that. Just before she was called to be a nurse, that she feels it and has to then occasionally put a shit in her conversation at work in order to then have any kind of inner communication. And I think on a lesser basis that might be true of all of us on some things that we might do.
I suppose you could think of that even as clergy, for clergy too, because still the stereotype on TV tends to be
that's
the most obnoxious kind of people,
and that's all they know. It's
just not real, just somebody who's kind of
I'm sitting here listening in and I'm beginning to think, who have we got left?
No, we don't.
I mean, that's what
Nancy suggested what we have left is white, middle class, male.
Slender.
Without an accent. And so, which laughingly brings us to the realization of what we're really like, that we continuously, all of us are excluded sometime or other, some way, and therefore all of us have sort of that responsibility. But the more nearly we are white class middle American and live in it, the more we have the responsibility. Charles, why don't you give them your concept, which I thought was so good, of the responsibility that the in-group has for the out-group.
Yeah, I mentioned last session when I was here in terms of and I don't know if I can re-articulate it, but it's necessary for the in-group to give the out-group some permission, you know, to give their gift and to affirm that by my exclusion of them, I am diminished. My world is smaller. And that somehow we have to be able to affirm that gift in those people who are outside. I use the illustration of someone who's mentally retarded. Imagine that they have any gift to give us. And in my former parish, we had an activity center for retarded adults, and I learned more from them about community and caring than I learned from our competitiveness. And so we have to give, you know, we have to be, and there probably will only be a few people who have the sensitivities But it'll have to be somebody in the inside group who helps us to get in touch with that. And then there will have to be those on the outside. Only the outsider can speak for the outsider. And you say, who's left? Only those who are left, because by its very nature, we often don't know who we exclude. I think they're often invisible to us, whether that's something we do intentionally or unconsciously or whatever. I think it's interesting when you were mentioning about your feelings about Holden and about the weight and all that. None of us really wanted to hear that. So we wanted to give you all kinds of suggestions and ways to avoid that. But to hear the pain of what that is, we have real trouble hearing that. We want to come to Holden's defense or whatever kind of things. And that's not to give a person permission, I think, in terms of a way that helps us in our pluralism. And if I understand anything, I think, about God's gifts, it is that they are given with profuse diversity. God is the great prodigal in terms of gifting things. And I think our gift maybe would be the Holy Spirit to help us to affirm gifts of difference. And I really have trouble with that. I have most trouble with that in my own field of theology. I am the least accepting of people whose theology is different than mine. If they're black and fat and a woman and have the right theology, fine. But if they're white and thin and male and have the wrong theology, I cross them out.
I think Mary Schramm in her Gifts of Grace really tries to make us aware of the talents. And I think in closing, in looking at what Francis talks about, some of the highlights I think that what helps us go away with a desire, at least, to be more inclusive and to not be so hurt by exclusion, which I think is a double standard, because all of us are included in this discussion. But if we were to then go outside and four of us talk while our husbands or friends come up and never tell them what the discussion was about, then we really have had a form of exclusion. So we're always included and excluded in life. And we have to serve in both roles and try to work towards a kind of sainthood. But the whole both secular and sacred result of inclusion, I think, is clear in what Francis says, and I'll read you just a couple passages. The ideal of poverty accepted by women multiplied the strength of men and rendered the beauty of the message universal. And then he says, it's strange, I've asked myself many times, how is it possible that in spite of the personages as remarkable as Claire, Catherine, you and the church are still so anti-feminist? Yes, I have to say, I'm Francis. You are still anti-feminist. I can't understand. Have you fear of a woman because a woman endangers your virtues? Or do you consider her, without openly saying so, as belonging to an inferior race, unworthy to touch the holy thing? But do you realize, now and then you even forbid her to ascend the altar, reverent to read the assembly text? One would say that you have no prophecy, that you have no truth to proclaim. Above all, one would say then that women and you people are still living in the past. And then he goes on to say, however, the woman is ordained, she is not in the nunnery, and we talked last hour about that. She didn't want to be a part of the nunnery. She wanted to be a part of St. Francis' work because she thought that is what fit her, and that she needed to do that, and that we sometimes need a role that people don't want us in, but that if there is that need, that's the role that will serve us best. We have an awful lot of surgeons that don't think women make good surgeons. They're too emotional. But the fact is, their finger dexterity makes them better surgeons, and they are out right now at Johns Hopkins and the Wilmer Eye Clinic looking for women eye surgeons because the studies have shown their finger dexterity. They ought to be dentists, but they aren't.
Open heart surgeons, they'd be beautiful chest pleasures.
Same kind of happening, and St. Francis said we've got to do that. And yet he makes clear that you do not copy men. And so we don't cop as blacks, they ought not to be copying the whites, but still accepted. So in all trades, that we do have unique features. And so he's saying that Claire does not take away her femininity by being a preacher or a pastor or following the poverty that is given. but that instead her unique contributions become a part of it. And we have made women in our society different in terms of our nurturing, mothering, or whatever. And that we can use those unique talents in the church and outside of the church, and we need not categorize them, but to realize that one can make their own models. Now, that is sort of what is significant in the dealings. And then where he talks about, as I mentioned earlier, he returns Claire to her office of service eventually. And so that I think what he's saying is that we have all kinds of functions and that we should not be afraid to return to a woman function, as it were. I think that's one of the problems with the women's movement, is that they are never willing to be that which they also could do well. Mm-hmm. That they don't think about the importance of being unique. And also, however, being a part of the masses in what their tradition has given them. So I think ultimately what we may have gained or can gain from this is the whole concept of not, as my title says, a saint for everyone, but rather that everyone can be a saint, mm-hmm, in how we deal with human beings. Mm-hmm.